I'm so glad I found you. I'm so glad to see you here. It's so good you're here. I'm so glad. Glad that you come. This is such a special day. And I'm so glad to be able to talk to you about it. Oh, this day, you call it Easter. I tell you, it was a day that was very, very confusing to me. Let me introduce myself. My name is Cleopas. Do you know that name? It doesn't look like many of you know my name. Well, I was a follower of Jesus. Not one of the 12 disciples, but I was a follower. And being his follower, that time was the highlight of all of my time with Jesus. But let me begin at the beginning. You see, they say that some things are too good to be true. I believe that. And the news that I heard that day made me think, this is too good to be true. And yet I came to understand that some news is so good that it can only be true by the power of God. And that is my story. In fact, my story very much concerns the mission of God. And whether you know it or not, you are part of that mission. And that's what I want to tell you about today. It was in this same time of year, the month of Nisan, as we called it. You call it April. It was a time when we were to celebrate Passover. Passover that year was particularly exciting because all of Jerusalem was buzzing. You see, Jesus was coming, and for months he had been talking about his kingdom. He had been talking about what God would do, and it seemed that he was about ready to declare himself to be the Messiah of Israel. Now, you need to understand, there were many who claimed to be messiahs. Most of them planned to revolt against oppressors of Rome. And yet, all of those who went against the power of Rome felt the might of Rome, and they were squashed. But Jesus was different. Oh, there were those who were part of his followers who were revolutionaries and who wanted to see the overthrow of the Roman government. But that wasn't what Jesus said. He said, give to Caesar what is Caesar's. Give Rome its due. Now, Jesus, when he set himself up as Messiah, he seemed to have a different agenda altogether. Didn't really matter to me. All that mattered was I had seen him work miracles. I had heard him teach. And when he spoke with the power of God. I tell you, I would have followed him anywhere. Now, as with most messiahs, Jesus had his enemies. You might be surprised, though, who the enemies of Jesus would be. Most people might think that the Romans would be his enemies. After all, most of the messiahs were planning revolt, but that wasn't Jesus' plan. He had something much, much bigger than simply a little revolt. No, the fact is, the people who were his greatest enemies were the people we respected the most. They were our Jewish religious leaders. Because it seemed that whatever Jesus was saying didn't quite fit what they had been teaching us. You see, our leaders were very much into rituals, and that was kind of their thing. But when Jesus talked about a relationship with God, it was much more about righteousness and much less about all of the rituals. Anyway, As I watched, it became apparent that those who opposed Jesus, their opposition grew stronger. And yet those who were supportive of Jesus were more and more excited about him. And this was the time when Jesus was coming to Jerusalem. This was the time when we believed he would declare himself to be our Messiah. And so that Sunday, you call it Palm Sunday? Was his day of choice. It was the day that he decided to have his triumphal entry into Jerusalem. So much for triumph. He rode on a colt of a donkey. I would have preferred a white stallion. But anyway, he was clearly declaring himself the Messiah. And all of those who gathered in the streets threw down palm branches and their cloaks. And they said, "Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. God saves." And I was one of them. I was celebrating along with all of them because this was good news. I had made my trip from my home in Emmaus, about a day's journey, maybe less than that. But I had come just to be part of that. And if that was the apex of Jesus' declaration, it seemed that it went downhill pretty fast from there. I mean, even that day when he rode into Jerusalem, once he got into Jerusalem, the first thing he did is he went to the temple and he had an argument with the religious leaders. He turned over their tables. He said that you've made this place a den of thieves. I tell you, it's not a good way to win friends and influence people to call them thieves. But he did it. And yet, as the days went by in that week leading up to Passover, it became apparent, very apparent, that the opposition to Jesus was growing stronger by the day. The days turned into nights and turned halfway into the week, we got to that Thursday, and already by Thursday, it seemed that everything had changed. I was not there because I was not part of the 12, but I heard rumors that night, as Jesus met with his disciples, he was not excited. He was not the vibrant king that we expected. He started talking about betrayal and about suffering. It was really rather discouraging to everyone who was gathered. Well, if that wasn't bad enough, the next morning when I woke up on that Friday, early in the morning, I heard rumors. Rumors that Judas, one of the most trusted of the 12, had betrayed Jesus, sold him out for money, and sold him over to the Jewish leaders. And the worst part about the rumors is I discovered they were true. I ventured out into Jerusalem and I saw that the Sanhedrin had a trial, you might call it, but it was no trial. It was a kangaroo court. The outcome had already been determined. The Jewish leaders simply wanted not guilt or innocence. They wanted to be done with Jesus once and for all. But I knew something. I knew that under our Roman oppressors, that the Jewish leaders didn't have the authority to execute anyone. So as much as they wanted to be rid of Jesus, I knew they couldn't be. And I felt that even though Rome wasn't my favorite authority, in this case, I believe the Roman justice would prevail. Sure enough, the Sanhedrin, having already determined that Jesus must go, took him to Pilate's court. And they made their case that he claimed to be a king and that his kingship was contrary to following Caesar. It was treasonous, they said. He should be executed. But as Pilate asked questions, as he interviewed him, it became apparent that Pilate was not at all convinced that Jesus was worthy of death. But Pilate was quite the politician, and he knew that it didn't pay to make enemies out of the religious leaders. After all, the religious leaders were the ones who kept the people in line, and keeping the people in line was very advantageous to Pilate. And so rather than get embroiled in this whole thing, he said, Herod is in residence. I'll send him to Herod and let Herod make the decision. But Herod wanted nothing to do with this as well. And having heard from Jesus, he sent him back to Pilate and said, you take care of it. It's your jurisdiction, Pilate. Pilate was threatened, but he could find nothing wrong with Jesus. So under the pressure of the Jews, he had Jesus beaten and said, now take him. But this didn't satisfy the Jews. They were determined to be rid of him. And they said, he must be crucified. And they kept demanding it. And the crowds, those crowds that had been there on that Palm Sunday cheering Jesus, many of those people were jeering. And were shouting, crucify him! Crucify him! And finally, Pilate, the coward that he was, washed his hands of the whole thing as if he could deny his part in it. And he turned Jesus, the greatest man I ever knew, the most righteous man I ever knew, over to this mob to be crucified. They mocked him. They insulted him. They put a crown of thorns upon his head and they beat it into his head. And they feigned worship and praise. And they led him to Golgotha's hill. And there on that hill they put one hand up against a cross and another hand against that Roman execution rack. And they nailed his hands to the cross and his feet there. And they left him there to die. I did not know what this was all about. I did not understand why it was happening. I didn't understand why God would allow it to happen, but it did. And when Jesus died on that cross, everything that I hoped for, all that I had dreamed that this Messiah would bring to our country, that would bring to me, it all was crucified with him. That was on a Friday. You call it Good Friday. I call it a national disaster. Our Messiah had come and we crucified him. But because it was the beginning of the Sabbath, as the sun went down, they took his body off of that cross and they hastily put it in a grave, the grave of a rich man named Nicodemus. Because it was the Sabbath, nothing was done on that Saturday. But the Sunday, some of the women who were followers with me and with the disciples, they had gone to the tomb and they were going to anoint Jesus' body. They didn't have time to do that before he was placed in the grave. But when they got to the grave, you know what they saw? They reported that they saw that the stone that had been placed in front of the tomb had been rolled away, and that instead of finding the body of Jesus inside, there were two angels. And they came back, these women who were clearly upset by all they had seen. And they said, he's alive! He is alive from the dead! And they were so persuasive that they made Peter go. And Peter went, and John, and they looked in the tomb, but they didn't know what they were seeing. I ask you, if it had been your friend, someone you loved dearly, and you were there at the funeral, and you saw them put the body in the grave. And then 2 days later, your friends came back and they said, oh, she's alive! She's alive! Would you have thought they were telling you the way things are or the way things they wanted them to be? I tell you, that great news, as I said before, seemed too good to be true. As much as I wanted it to be true, I knew that people don't rise from the dead. I knew that there was a rumor that had been started. It had actually been started, apparently, by the Jews. They said that Jesus' disciples had stolen the body. That's why the tomb was empty. But I knew that Jesus' disciples had not stolen the body. Some of them thought he was alive from the dead. And even if they wanted to steal the body, they couldn't have stolen the body because Pilate had seen, the Jewish leaders had seen to it that Pilate would post Roman soldiers in front of that tomb. Centurions who Jesus' defeated disciples could not have overthrown. I knew that Jesus' disciples couldn't have stolen the body if they wanted to, and I knew that our Jewish leaders wouldn't have stolen the body if they could. After all this did was add fuel to the fire of who Jesus was. But it left me empty, wondering what explanation could there possibly be for all that was happening. I tell you, I couldn't make sense of it. All I knew was Jesus was gone. And everything that I had come that weekend to Jerusalem to do was no longer relevant. And so I decided to make the 7-mile journey back with a companion of mine to my home in Emmaus to somehow try to sort it all out. We began our trip. There really wasn't a whole lot to say, but you know that when we spoke, the only thing there was to speak about was all that took place over the course of that weekend, trying to make sense of it all, and none of it made sense. As we walked along, a stranger came along beside us. And he said, "What are you talking about?" I have to tell you, when he said that, I had a flush of anger. I thought, what else would you talk about? Doesn't everyone know what took place in Jerusalem that weekend? And I said, we were talking about Jesus, about all that happened this weekend. And he said, what happened? I thought, are you the only person in Jerusalem who has no idea what happened? And so I proceeded to explain to him all that Jesus meant to me and all that he had said and all that he had done and how we were convinced he was a great prophet of God who worked miracles and we had placed all of our hopes on him. But now he was gone. Now I'd seen him crucified. And now there were rumors that he was alive from the dead, and it didn't make sense. This stranger, who seemed as if he knew nothing about what was going on in Jerusalem, took a tone that, if he hadn't had the care in his voice when he said this, I would have been ready to fight him. He said, "How foolish you are, and how slow to believe all the things that the Scriptures say about the Messiah." He said, "Didn't the Messiah have to suffer before he entered into glory?" I tell you, it was something I had never thought of. This was not in my understanding of what a Messiah was or what a Messiah did. But on our road to Emmaus, this stranger became our teacher. And he began to unfold our Hebrew Scriptures to point out the very mission of God. And he began with Moses, moved on to the Psalms and then to the prophets, and he spelled out God's plan. He started in Genesis, the book of Moses, in that idyllic spot called Eden, where man and woman were together in a sinless, perfect place, and yet they spoiled it all by their disobedience of the one command God had given them. And from their sin, everything fell apart. But that didn't thwart God's mission. God had a plan, and he called forth a man by the name of Abraham. And he promised Abraham, he said, "From Abraham, from you, you who have no children, you will be the father of many nations. And through you, all of the world will be blessed." And as we walked along, he said, "And you know, it was from Abraham that your people, the people of Israel, came. And yet they ended up in Egypt, and they were enslaved in Egypt. And as slaves, God sent a deliverer. And God sent judgments upon the people of Egypt. And one of those judgments was the angel of death. And the prophecy was that this angel would pass over homes where a lamb had been slain and where the blood had been placed on the lintel and on the doorposts of each house. And where that took place, the angel passed over and the plague did not visit that house." This stranger said, "Do you think that that was just about your people thousands of years ago? Wasn't it that that lamb pointed to a greater lamb? Do you think that in the law, in your law that calls for sacrifices of bulls and goats to take away sin, that an animal could ever take away your sin? Weren't those pointers to something greater? I had never thought of any of this." But as he proceeded to talk and as we walked to Emmaus, there was a spark within me and it became a glowing ember. He said, "What about the psalmist? Do you remember the psalmist?" He said, "All who see me mock me. They hurl insults at me. They have pierced my hands and my feet." The psalmist wrote that 1,000 years before Golgotha. The script had already been written. And then the prophets. Remember the prophet Zechariah, he said? Didn't he say, "Strike the shepherd and the sheep will be scattered"? You are witnesses of these things. And then he spoke again of Zechariah in a way that sounded more like testimony than prophecy. He said, "They will look upon him whom they have pierced, and they will mourn for him like one mourns for an only child." I began to think, this stranger, he knows something. And he was unfolding for us God's mission. His mission to redeem a broken world. And he said, "What about the prophet Isaiah?" He said, "You know what he said. Surely he has borne our iniquities and carried our sorrows. But we considered him stricken by God, smitten by him, and afflicted. But he was pierced for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. The chastisement that brought us peace was upon him, and by his stripes we are healed. It was all written hundreds of years before. And as this stranger told me this news, I knew this was the greatest news of all time. I understood that God had a mission, and that mission involved the Messiah. He hadn't come just to deliver Israel from the Romans. He'd come to save a lost world, to save broken men and women from the brokenness of their sin. I realized this was amazing. Well, it was at that time that we got to my home in Emmaus. And I realized I'd been talking to this man all afternoon, listening to him, hanging on his every word, and I didn't even know his name. I didn't even know where he was from. All I knew was he was planning to go on down the road, and I couldn't let him go. I said, "No, you must stay. You must have dinner with us. We haven't eaten all day. Please, please have dinner with us." So we invited him into my home. And though I am the host and I try to be a good host, somehow this stranger was our teacher. So it seemed only right when he took the bread and gave thanks and broke it. And as he did, I remembered that day when that little boy brought his lunch and he had 5 loaves of bread, and Jesus took those loaves and he broke them and he gave them and he fed thousands of people. And I remembered that other day on the side of the mountain when Jesus said, it wasn't Moses who gave you the bread from heaven. The bread that comes down from heaven that brings life. I am the bread of life. And I realized, sitting at our table, breaking our bread, was the resurrected Messiah, Jesus himself, right before us. And as soon as I recognized that he was gone, I turned to my friend. I said, "Weren't our hearts burning within us as he opened the scriptures and declared God's mission to us?" Well, we knew what we had to do. We had to go back to Jerusalem to tell the disciples, to tell them what we had seen, to tell them that Jesus was, in fact, alive. When we got to Jerusalem, before we had a chance to say anything, the disciples came running to us and they said, "You'll never guess. Jesus appeared to Peter. Jesus is alive." And I said, "You'll never guess who I spent my afternoon with. You'll never guess that the one we spent our days and our weeks and our months with was far greater than we could even imagine." And as I was talking to them there in the room, suddenly Jesus appeared. It was a spooky thing to have someone just show up in the room, and we weren't sure who it was. We thought it was a ghost. I mean, how does that happen? But he held out his hands and he showed us the wounds caused by sin and allowed by love. And he said, "Let me tell all of you the mission of God." And once again, from the Holy Scriptures, he spelled out to everyone what he had told to me and my companion. And when he was finished, you know what he said? He said, "You are my witnesses." The greatest news I had ever heard. The Messiah had not come simply to redeem Israel, simply to save our nation from our oppressors, the Romans. His plan was far greater. He had come to redeem us, to redeem all men and all women. By by his death on a cross. All he asks is that we embrace that we believe it, that we accept it. That is the mission of God. But that mission has another part. We are witnesses. You come here today to celebrate, as I do, this great news. But do you understand that this news is not ours to keep? The mission of God is not simply for us. God sent the Messiah as a Savior for all the world to take the brokenness and to heal it. And if you have embraced that and you have been saved, then you have a mission to save the world. That is why I'm here. That is your mission. To realize all that God has done to forgive you, to save you. And if you have been saved, you take that news and the power that He has given you, and you go out and you save the world. That's the greatest mission of all.